Briefs and oral arguments. Our third case of the morning is number 051091, the United States against Ryan D. Evans. Mr. Murphy.
May it please the court, Judge Ripple, Judge Cuddy, Judge Wood. My client, Ryan Evans, was convicted of insider trading as a tippee under tipper-tippee analysis. The legal issue at the heart of this case concerns whether that conviction can stand in the circumstance in which the district court, erroneously removed from the jury's consideration an essential element of that case, namely, whether the tipper breached his fiduciary duty by disclosing material non-public information for his own personal benefit. The district court's ruling created a situation in which the tipper's state of mind was irrelevant, and that is in direct contravention of Supreme Court precedent.
You know, Mr. Murphy, sometimes the Supreme Court doesn't write with as clear a pen as other times, and Dirks, it seems to me, leaves open the possibility, and I guess what we have to decide is whether it's there, that the tipper could be disclosing, let's say, negligently in breach of his fiduciary duty, but for personal gain, let's say a gift to his friend, the tippee, and the savvy tippee realizes what's happened, goes off with all the right scienter, and trades on the basis of that information. In a circumstance where the tipper would not be found liable because the scienter wouldn't be there, there's even a footnote in Dirks that says the issue isn't whether the tipper, in that case, Sechrist or Dirks, acted with scienter, but whether there was any deceptive or fraudulent conduct at all, et cetera. There's some very core legal issues at the heart of the argument you're presenting, and I think they have to do with how direct a link does there have to be between what the tipper has done that was wrong and what the tippee does?
Well, I think that from my reading of Dirks, and I would agree with the court that not all Supreme Court precedent is absolutely clear, but I do believe that in this case, Dirks was fairly clear about what it held was required for a tipper and tippee liability case. And what the court basically said, its first premise, was that not all disclosures by a fiduciary amount to fraud, if
right.
you will.
That's right.
And that, therefore, since it's derivative liability, since the tippee's liability derives from the improper conduct, if you will, of the tipper, a jury would have to consider the tipper's state of mind, is scienter. The court, you asked the question and spoke about the issue regarding whether or not there was a gift. The fact of the matter is there is some language in some of the cases that a gift may constitute, so that there's no actual tangible material benefit,
right.
but that there's
including
a gift coming
back. Including
in
Dirks itself. Dirks says.
That's correct. But the reality is the courts have said that's a benefit.
Right.
So the jury should be instructed to say, if you want to find a gift, you can find a gift, but that's a personal benefit. The jury below was not asked to consider whether or not a personal benefit was in the mind of, in this case, Paul Johnamore, the tipper. And that's critical.
Well, I mean, what the jury was asked was whether this defendant, Mr. Evans, knew that there had been a breach of fiduciary duty on the part of Mr. Johnamore, and whether he then, you know, went ahead and traded in the light of that. And I guess that's the one step removed. They did find that he knew that there was this breach, and there was this breach.
Well, I guess I'd beg to differ a little bit. They were asked to find whether or not he knew that there was a breach. The court essentially streamlined the jury's finding to get to breach. The court basically, in its instructions and in its rulings, and when this court gets back to an opportunity to analyze all of the record on this, it will see that the district court essentially equated disclosure with breach. It made no distinction about the purpose of the disclosure, and that's really what lies at the heart of this case. The purpose of the disclosure determines under 10b-5 whether it's a breach. Yes, it was a person who has a fiduciary responsibility and to a corporation, for instance, and discloses that information, may breach it in an unethical way, may breach it in a civil context, but that doesn't mean that is a breach of a fiduciary duty as that is understood under 10b-5.
Doesn't this get down to that word also in the district court's instructions? Isn't this your instructions point? I mean, if he hadn't said also, if he had said the elements of fiduciary duty and exploitation of non-public information may exist when a person who has insider status makes a gift, isn't that all you need?
No, I think that the jury should have also been charged that it has to assess whether or not Mr. Johnimore intended to receive a benefit as a first matter. And then it can say you can find that a gift is a benefit. But it has to ask the jury to consider whether or not a benefit was what was sought by Mr. Johnimore, because the courts have basically said without that benefit, without seeking that benefit, the tipper is not committing a deceptive practice under 10b-5 and therefore is not committing a fraud under the securities law. So it's highly important and very crucial that the jury be asked to consider that. In the first trial, the court gave the proper instructions. And lo and behold, Mr. Johnimore was acquitted on all counts. Mr. Evans was acquitted on the conspiracy count. It isn't an insignificant charge to the jury in this case. Our position is that the judge failed to provide that instruction properly, and we therefore couldn't argue benefit to the jury. We were precluded essentially from arguing that. So the jury was left in a situation where all they were told to do was essentially, if you found that Mr. Johnimore disclosed, that's a breach. If you find that Mr. Evans knew that he had given him inside information, then it's insider trading.
Well,
and that's not simply the law.
Is that what it was, or was it if you find that Mr. Evans knew that Mr. Johnimore had breached his fiduciary duties?
But that's his fiduciary duties as defined by the district court, which was essentially an inaccurate description of what constituted breach. Because essentially the government's position here is very similar to the SEC's position in Dirks, which was the losing side. Their position here, taken to its logical extreme, basically says if you're in possession of insider information and you trade on it, you're guilty of insider trading. And that is really not at all, in fact, that's contrary to what Dirks
stands for. I don't think the government's going quite that far. Whether it fits this fact pattern or not is a different question, but I think the government is leaving open the possibility that there could be kind of a naive tipper who is trying to, you know, just do a favor for his friend, and a very savvy tippee who recognizes that the breach of the fiduciary duty, the personal benefit, all of the elements basically for tipper liability are there. The tippee says, aha, I've got a great chance, runs off, trades, you know, 5 hours later the tender offer, whatever it is announced. So I think the government leaves open the possibility that although there's derivative liability in a certain sense, it's not so strong that there actually has to be a conviction of the tipper before the tippee can be convicted.
Well, I guess what I would say, Judge, is that if there is a naive tipper who discloses confidential information for no reason.
Negligently,
yeah. Or because he just has a big mouth and he talks a lot and doesn't realize the consequences of what he's saying.
And he's trying to make a gift to his friends. You know,
that's not a naive tipper.
Well,
if he's trying to tip, he's giving. If he's trying to give a gift, he's asking. He's providing. He's getting a benefit. That's what the courts have said. If he's truly a naive tipper, then he is not doing anything that amounts to fraud. He is not acting deceptively, and therefore, under Dirks, under 10b-5, that cannot be. He cannot be liable, and if he cannot be liable, the tippee can't be liable. Even if the tippee knows.
You're putting an awful lot of weight on this idea of derivative liability. It seemed to me to be saying that means their liability virtually merges.
Well, I
think we've got two instances of liability here, and they are not identical.
They're not identical, but one is contingent upon the other. And I put great weight on it because the Supreme Court put great weight on it in Dirks. The reality is that the only trades that can be subject to insider trading violations are those in which there is a breach of a fiduciary duty for an improper purpose. That improper purpose comes from
breach,
the tipper.
Right?
Pardon?
Can't be a negligent breach. You're saying it has to be a criminal breach.
That's correct. It has to be.
Where did the Supreme Court say that?
In Dirks, it has held that the tipper, if the state of mind of the tipper, it's the relationships there and the state of mind of the tipper that controls these. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time now, so I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
We hear now from Mr. Rayl.
May it please the court, Praveen Rao on behalf of the United States. The defendant is not able to show that the first jury's general verdict, as to Jianmar, barred his retrial on the insider trading counts.
Well, that's one of his arguments, but I would like you to explain to me, once again, I'm sure you've done it in your brief, but how you understand the following two sentences from Dirks. The first one appears at page 664, probably, of the Supreme Court's opinion. It says, "We believe that there must be a breach of the insider's fiduciary duty before the tippee inherits the duty to disclose or abstain." And the second sentence is a page or two later. It says, "In the absence of a breach of duty to shareholders by the insiders, there was no derivative breach by Dirks." So the idea of derivative liability is squarely there in the Supreme Court's opinion. And then if you go back and you see where the court's trying to explain what they mean by breach of fiduciary duty, there's a long discourse on the purpose of the disclosure. And my concern is, how clearly was the purpose of Mr. Giannamore's disclosures presented as a question that this jury in Mr. Evans's second trial had to consider?
Well, what the district court did is tailor the jury instructions for the facts that were there.
But sometimes you cut off part that needs to stay. You know, we want to know what the scissors were like, you know, and if he was cutting off something that should have stayed there, then we have a problem.
And in Dirks, it says that in large part that the improper purpose can be proven by the benefit. There may be other ways that it can be proven. It doesn't foreclose that idea. Benefit is one way. But as Your Honor did point out earlier, you could have the idea of a savvy tippee and a naive tipper.
But then how do you get, if it's the naive tipper, how can you get the insider's tip being a breach of the fiduciary duty because the purpose of the disclosure is personal benefit? Why? How can you be both naive and seeking a personal benefit at the same time?
In this case, it's possible that it'd be naive because it was still given as a gift, as a friend. And Giannamore, in this case, may not have known the contours of what his fiduciary duty was. In fact, that was an argument that they made in the first trial through Mark Halber, that he didn't exactly know the contours. His training was not sufficient. So it's conceivable that Giannamore gave this tip to the tippee, Mr. Evans, but he didn't know what the contours of his fiduciary duty was, and he still received the benefit because he gave it as a gift to a friend, And then I'd also point out, of adding these additional elements to the basic two elements that they're there.
Do you think he had to know that it was inside information when he gives it to Evans?
Well, he knew that there was a fiduciary duty to this.
And well, see, what I'm getting at is suppose he hadn't been paying that much attention to his Wall Street journals lately, and he thought that there was lots of buzz in the newspapers about a potential tender offer of some of these companies. And so, you know, not everybody spends all their time reading the Wall Street Journal, so he passes this along to Evans because he knows Evans needs some money and is going to trade. And he says, you know, this is great, this tender offer is about to happen. And he, in the back of his mind, thinks everybody knows about it. In fact, Evans well knows that no one knows about it, that this is brand new, and so Evans rushes off and trades. Is that enough scienter on, or is that enough motive on Janamore's part to suffice?
That still is the motive if we look at Dirk's, because he's still driving the benefit. But it's not a knowing breach, and it's not something that can be imputed to Evans, that he has to know what's in Janamore's mind when he gets that benefit. He doesn't have to know that there's a benefit being given, because that's entirely possible, that he gets this tip and he trades upon it and he gets the benefit, but he doesn't know that Janamore is himself getting the benefit because he's given to the friend and he has these good feelings.
But the problem under Dirks is if Janamore had had the same kind of motivation that we saw in the Dirks case itself, somebody's trying to be a whistleblower, they want to show, you know, there's some terrible activity going on, as was the case with the equity funding scandals, Evans still gets the same benefit. He still earns all the money. He does the trades, and yet he can't be liable.
But in Dirks, the tipper was doing it, as the court held, almost purely for altruistic reasons. There was no benefit at all, and I think that is the key point here, Janamore.
But you do have to agree, though, that you needed to know why the tipper was doing it, because the tippee is off the hook on Dirks, in the Dirks holding.
Yes, but it's not something that, this is a very unusual case where we have a tippee without a tipper. It's not a case where that has to be proven as to the tipper. And also, because of the facts of this case, the court's instructions saying that it can also be shown through this benefit of giving. That's something the jury did hear, because that was tailored specifically for this case where there was nothing else. The only improper purpose that existed would have been for the benefit. There was no evidence that somehow Janamore was profiting himself. The only evidence that was presented was that they were friends, they hung out together every day, they socialized together, and as a result, the only benefit that could accrue would be giving as a gift to a friend. So the instructions.
But your opponent argues, essentially, that's a harmless error argument on the instructions, because the jury was never told. The jury might have thought no benefit at all, even gift. If it's A or gift, and they don't think there's a gift, they might have decided that there was nothing.
By making the tippee no more than what's in Dirks, and even in Dirks they lay out just the two elements, so there's a breach of fiduciary duty and the tippee knew about that, it would lead to absurd results. It would lead to a loophole where the tippee would get a windfall. For example, as we cite, there could be a case where a tipper gives information and has ulterior motives of later wanting the stock to go down himself, and the tippee doesn't know about that. Because the tippee doesn't know the defendant's or the tipper's motive, that somehow he gets off scot-free and he gets a windfall, that would lead to those sort of results if you had that. If you imputed and required that the tippee to know why the tipper was actually making that tip.
But, I mean, one thing you could certainly have to take out of Dirks, though, is that the Supreme Court reads these insider trading rules in a way that some tippees are going to get a windfall, right?
Yes, some tippees would get a windfall under Dirks, and in Dirks, those tippees, in fact, did. They get a windfall, and because in that case, the tipper had no ulterior motive, as that court found, was doing it purely altruistically to help with the investigation and to disseminate truthful information. Right. Here, that's not the case. There's no indication that Janamore was disseminating that information to bring the truth out. These were all proper tender offers, or they were proper mergers that were going on. I would also point to the court in Libera, where the defendant in that case tried to add an extra element to tippee liability by saying the tipper somehow needed to know that the actual purpose of the tip was something improper. That court and the Second Circuit has held in other courts like Falcone and in Chestnut that there is no additional requirement besides the two requirements laid out. As for the other issue of whether Mr. Halber's testimony should have been allowed in the second trial, that wasn't relevant, as we've discussed, because John Moore's state of mind wasn't relevant. If we do follow from our prior idea that only those two elements needed to be proved and not his state of mind. And finally, if the court finds that the insider trading counts should stand, the Williams Act counts should also stand, because the willfulness element comes from the insider trading. If the court were to reverse the insider trading counts against the defendant, there's still sufficient evidence to show there was willfulness on defendant's part, because he was a sophisticated stock trader. He was adept at business. He traded. His pattern of trading showed that he held these stocks less than 24 hours or 24 hours before he sold. He made a significant amount of profit and then didn't disclose it. And also notably, his consciousness of guilt was shown that when the SEC called him up after the Burns trade a month afterwards, he told the SEC that he traded based on research. And when pressed, he hung up. A few months later, when his employer got a subpoena, he indicated that he didn't even recall the trades. All those together, and these were factors that were not in the Cassius case the defendant relies on. These were all factors that were not there. The defendant here had that shows willfulness, and thus the Williams Act should be affirmed. Unless there are any further questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. How much time does Mr. Murphy have? Sure, you have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. Let me first sort of go back and sort of deal with the tautology, I think, that the government has come up with here. The government keeps talking about it doesn't matter whether Mr. Evans knew or didn't know about the purpose or state of mind. Of course, we're not exactly saying that. But the important point here is that a tippy cannot know of a tipper's breach unless the tipper's actually breached. I mean, if Paul John Moore doesn't breach, there's no way that he can know of it. The government talks about this being a naive trader and he's just providing a gift and there's no other explanation for it. I would dispute factually, without spending too much of the court's time on that characterization. But again, where the government is getting it wrong is that gift is a benefit. And at least the jury should have been charged to say, to determine if there was a personal benefit that was intended by Paul John Moore by giving a gift. I don't think it was a gift, but I think that's fair to say.
But you know, let me come at it this way. Insider trading, of course, is an area where a lot of sometimes sophisticated legal characterization of what somebody has done has to take place. It's not like, you know, running a red light or something. And what I want to know is whether you are, in effect, asking us to disagree with the test that the Second Circuit used in the Mayo case. Or sorry, that was our case. But the Second Circuit's Falcone case, other cases, this court in Mayo, where we said you have tippy liability if the insider's disclosure was improper and the tippy knew or should have known that it was improper. End of discussion.
I'm not disagreeing in general terms, but I'm saying what that means is the jury has to decide whether the tipper's motive was improper.
In order to answer the first question.
Okay. So the jury has to be asked, in conjunction with that question, what, as Dirk says, was there an effort to gain a personal benefit by the tipper? So it's not inconsistent. And I would say that the Libera case and Falcone, the cases that the government cited here a moment ago, those were cases that didn't deal with breach of duty. They didn't deal with the tipper's state of mind. It was not an issue. So they're really inapposite to this case. I guess I'd finally say if we could consider a circumstance, and again, I think the government's hypothetical begs the question again, because they're saying he gives a gift. That's a benefit. The jury has to consider that. But in a circumstance where three people at a country club on the golf course, two executives of a corporation talk about a significant transaction, material non-public information is disclosed amongst each other, caddy is standing there, hears it, knows who they are,
understands their positions, knows that it's material non-public information, and trades on it, and makes a hefty profit. That is not insider trading. That is not a violation of 10b-5. And that is the fatal flaw in the district court's analysis and the government's analysis, because the district court and the government basically say, yes, that caddy could be prosecuted. And that is not what Dirks holds, and that is not what the remaining precedent dealing with Dirks directly on this point hold.
But I think the government would distinguish the case where one of the executives turns to the caddy and says, listen carefully, son, I'm about to tell you something really valuable, and that the phone calls from Giannamore to Evans were of that stripe.
But if the government charged the caddy in that circumstance, the jury should be charged that they have to decide whether the CEO intended a benefit to the caddy. Mm-hmm. That's what we're saying went wrong here. That's what went haywire below, that there was not that charge to the jury. And in so doing, the jury was deprived of considering, and we were deprived of arguing, one of the most significant elements in a tip or tippy liability case. I see my red light is on. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Our fourth case of the day is number 05.